This is All In. I'm Miriam So. Today, we're talking about efforts to unionize in Indiana, and we'll be focusing on a union push in Kokomo from bus drivers, custodians, and other non-teacher school staff. It's based on reporting from Jeannie Lindsay, education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We're joined now by one of the people Jeannie talked to for her recent feature story about this push. Heather Jackson is a bus driver in Kokomo. Welcome to the program, Heather.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, what is it like to be a bus driver in Kokomo right now?
Well, right now it's chaotic, to be honest. We have been, over the past several years, you know, just getting shorter and shorter with drivers. And I know that's really an issue, not just here in Kokomo, it's really countrywide. But, you know, with being less and less drivers that we have, people, you know, drivers leaving to go to other school systems, you know, our buses are just getting packed even fuller and fuller because we don't have enough drivers to split them up more. So it's getting a little crazy, a little chaotic, and even hotter on the buses because we've got so many bodies in there.
And has it changed in recent years? Obviously, the pandemic has an effect, but have you seen things improving for bus drivers, or has it gotten worse?
I'd probably say it's gotten a little worse over the last few years.
And what makes it worse?
Just not having enough staff. You know, we've got the biggest school system around here in our county, and, you know, we've got little drivers to haul a lot of kids. And, you know, that just makes the kids more frustrated and cranky on the buses because they're crowded in there, especially right now when it's so hot and the buses don't have air conditioning. And then we got, you know, parents that are rightfully upset, you know, wondering where their kids' bus is, and they're standing out there at the bus stops. And, you know, with cranky kids on the bus, you sometimes get more fights and stuff like that. So, you know, it's, the parents are getting frustrated and stuff just as well as we are.
And that's got to be challenging also, not only for drivers, but bus aides. Do you have enough on your routes to keep up with what's going on?
Definitely not. And, you know, with being shorter on drivers this year, there were some changes that I'm assuming was part of, you know, losing even more drivers this year that, you know, we used to have so many special needs buses. We do still have some that are like basically more for wheelchair kids, but even those buses have, you know, got general education kids on it. And there's been special needs kids, you know, just spread out through the other buses. I've got some kids on my bus that, you know, their paperwork says they need an aide, but we don't always have enough aides to go around on all the buses.
And what's the problem if there aren't enough aides? Just for our listeners to understand who might think like, well, it's just a drive. You're going from what point A to point B. It can't be that difficult.
Well, you know, if you got one that's depending on what their disabilities are, you know, if they like to move around on the bus, you know, we do have, I do have seat belts on my buses as well as the other buses if the students require those. But, you know, if they know how to get out of them, you know, we got to pull over as quickly as we can if we have to deal with that. Or, you know, with the other kids being on the buses, you know, they may pick on the special needs kids if they're, you know, around them. Or so, you know, if we have an aide on the bus, I mean, they can address those situations while we're trying to keep an eye on the road and get the kids to school and, you know, back home in the afternoons.
So in terms of the unionizing and things that are being done right now, what are some of those steps that you're doing to try to fix what's going on?
Well, I mean, we've been addressing the board and trying to speak with them and, you know, find out why they wouldn't recognize us as a union. And we've collected signatures from the community on a petition. You know, we're still gathering signatures there, and we plan to present those to the board and hoping, you know, they see the community support, you know, that maybe that'll help change their mind, or at least, you know, have them to, you know, be more honest and open and tell us, you know, why they decided not to recognize us.
Is there anything that sets working in Kokomo apart from other cities that you've noticed?
Not that I've noticed. I know that, you know, all school systems and bus drivers have their issues. You know, I've born and raised here, so my girls go to Kokomo schools. So, you know, I've had offers to go to other county schools, but, you know, I've been at Kokomo for, you know, almost 13 years and my kids go there. So it's kind of hard for me to say, I'm going to give up and just go to another county school. So I stick around, but it's getting tough.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's pretty tough. And with trying to push for this union, what compelled you? Was there like a point when you were like, that's it, I'm all in with this?
Well, you know, it just losing more and more drivers, and we had to do something. And, you know, I'm not a big public speaker. I didn't take speech class in high school because I don't like getting up there, and I didn't have to have it to graduate. But, you know, it was like we needed somebody to step up and no one else was. So I thought, well, I'll do it. I'll be brave. no one else will brave up. I'm sure other people were the same way. They don't like to get up and talk in front of people. So, but you know, it just, we needed something to start moving, to start happening. So I just decided to, well, I guess I'll step up and I'll do it.
Well, I'm sure you're taking that step probably enabled other people to feel comfortable to take a step as well. Have you heard anything about other workers throughout this process that are supportive of this?
Well, I know we have the majority of our drivers and the aides, and like I, you know, the custodial and maintenance departments have also stepped up and wanted to join us. I know I'd been contacted a while back by someone who was a paraprofessional. I don't know that they haven't all joined with us yet, but I think, you know, more and more people probably will, you know, when we do get this push and they do finally see, okay, you know, we'll recognize you. Let's work together.
I mean, it sounds like people are coming together and you have some community support. Have you faced any opposition at all?
From the community in that, no. The community in that's been real supportive. The parents, you know, that are at the bus stops when I pick up their kids, they've been real supportive and, you know, helpful and understanding with, you know, buses being crowded and the issues I have on my bus with some kids. But, you know, there's been two board members that they voted yes for us, and the rest of them, you know, just voted no. And, you know, really haven't, you know, we've tried to talk to them, tried to contact them, email, you know, and they just keep saying it's a legal issue, which, you know, we don't, you know, help us to understand that because, you know, like we said, the teachers have a union. So why can't we, you know, what's the difference that, you know, you'll recognize that they have a union, but you won't recognize us.
Do you think any of them would ever come out on a bus ride, for example, to see what's going on and come up with some remedies?
You know, I have no idea if they would. I would love if they would, because, you know, we can tell people what goes on, but unless you get out of your office and come and really be in it, you'll never really know.
Well, what have you heard from other workers throughout this process? Is everyone in agreement about what they want for the outcome?
Yeah, I believe that they are. You know, it's been a long haul, you know, as far as, you know, not really getting a raise for many years. You know, we finally did, during this effort, they did finally give us a raise and gave us our 26 pays back, which helps us, you know, get paid through the summer. So we're not, you know, without, you know, 2 months without pay or trying to find a job that'll hire us just for a couple months. They gave the bus drivers and the mechanics a raise, but they did not give the aides a raise, and they really haven't addressed the maintenance and custodial yet. So, you know, we've gotten a couple things that we were working towards, but, you know, I really would like some of the focus, you know, to help the aides and the maintenance custodial now too.
Right. I mean, it seems kind of disheartening for folks to see their other coworkers getting raises and they're not getting anything.
Yeah. And we have, like, especially the aides, I don't know how many drivers we have at this point that are not considered full-time. But, you know, like, we have aides that work full-time, but they did not get, like, the different bonuses that we'll get. Like, we got, I don't know if you want to call it a bonus, they had a COVID appreciation stipend that they gave us over the summer that they announced. But, you know, like, our aides didn't get that, because they're not considered full-time. I forget the term that they always use, board certified, I think, employee, which basically means you're full-time, I think. But they did not get that because they're not board certified. So I think that's something, you know, they're working full-time hours. Right. So they should get this too. You know, they worked through the pandemic when we came back and the schools opened. You know, they should have gotten that too. That's things like that that needs to be fair across the board.
And you think being able to unionize would be able to get that fairness?
I think that it would help a lot. I think that would give us a bigger voice and, you know, better backing to do the things that we need to do. You know, I spoke at the board meeting and told them, you know, no one knows how to do our job better than we do. You know, they sit in their offices and they do their job. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know how to do their job because that's not our job. But we know our job. So it's like, let us speak and let you know what's going on, so, and give you some ideas so you know what would help the situation. But as of yet, they haven't sat down with us to do any of that. But
And that's what I was going to ask you is when you spoke to the school board, was there any response at all to what you brought up to them?
No. When they have let us speak at the school board, you have 3 minutes to speak. There's not any discussion, no questions after. And they time you. Your 3 minutes is up, you're done. So there was no discussion, no questions after that. They just let you say what you felt you wanted to say, and that was it.
Are you hopeful?
There's been no response otherwise.
Are you hopeful there will be a response or any change coming up?
I hope so. I hope they see that we're not giving up. We're not backing down. We really feel strongly about this and that there needs to be some changes and things happening so that we can attract drivers, that we can keep the drivers that we have, because we desperately need it. And aides, we need them.
And are you seeing anything changing at all from the efforts that you've made so far, or are you just kind of still waiting to see what's going to happen?
Well, like I said, the only changes that have come along, they did give us the raise and our 26 pays back. And they said that they were giving us an extra hour or extra half hour a day, which would give us a little extra money. But we were technically already getting that extra half hour a day anyway, because we clock in 15 minutes before we leave to do our routes in the morning and then 15 more minutes in the afternoon so that, we could fuel our buses and do that kind of stuff. So that was already an extra half an hour a day that we were already getting. So really that was just talk, I guess. So if they really are going to give that to us, because I drive about 6 hours and I already get that extra half an hour. So, if they're really going to give us an extra half an hour, then they'd bump it up to paying us 7 hours a day instead of 6.5. But at least we got to keep that extra half an hour.
Right. And so what is next now? What are your plans moving forward?
Well, like I said, we're going to continue going to the board meetings, continue try to speak at the board meetings, and we plan on gathering all the petitions and presenting them this month, September 13th, at the next board meeting. And then we'll see what goes from there and if that gets us anywhere and changes anything. And if not, we'll start thinking of our new next steps.
Well, thank you so much. We'll definitely keep in touch and see what happens next. Heather Jackson is a bus driver in Kokomo and part of an ongoing push to unionize with other non-teacher school staff. After a quick break, we'll be live with someone from a trade union for public employees, and later we'll talk to a professor of labor law to find out how this story fits into national trends. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about efforts to unionize by focusing on a union push from non-teacher school staff in Kokomo, Indiana. We're joined now by Ron Richmond, Director of Political Activity and Communication for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME. Welcome to the program, Ron.
Welcome. Thank you.
So, Ron, how many non-teacher school unions are there in Indiana?
Within AFSCME's reach, I'd say there are at least 5 or 6. Larger cities.
Is that a fair amount, or is that pretty small compared to, for example, other states?
I think it's about average.
So why aren't unions like this more common? We don't really hear about non-teacher school unions. We often hear about teacher unions when there are big news stories that come out, but we don't hear about the other folks.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, actually, because just like recent history with the COVID has really left a lot of people feeling exposed. So, but you think about the teachers and the risks of that job, but you also have to understand that all these support staff go hand in hand and they have the same risks, the same exposures. And they're starting to speak out now more than ever before and say, hey, why not us? We should be having the protection of a union as well.
Right. I mean, it sounds like a lot more people are thinking about joining or forming a union. But in general, is there a reason why this hasn't been a trend up until now?
I think sometimes it's pushback like we're getting from this group in Kokomo that, there's a lot of restrictions on school budgets. And I think, unfortunately, when you are balancing your budgets on kind of the human commodity, they try to keep a handful unorganized so that they can have a higher degree of flexibility or leverage over those people. And unfortunately, that's, you know, what happens in cases like this.
Well, speaking of Kokomo, for our listeners who may not know the whole story, can you explain what happened earlier this year when the school corporation voted on whether to recognize the union there?
Actually, this started way back in the fall. The group on their own had showed up at a school board meeting and had asked to speak on some of their concerns. And then they reached out to us afterwards. We drafted a letter to the superintendent to say the majority of this group, the vast majority, had signed cards seeking representation. And they didn't respond to the letter. In fact, it seemed like the next thing we heard was they had a hurried vote at a board meeting where they voted no, and still to this day haven't directly contacted either these employees or the union to explain why. They've been quoted in a paper saying that that there was some legal prohibition, which from our consultations with our attorney, there are no prohibitions. It's just a matter of what you choose or choose not to do.
Can something like that be overridden if they're saying that based on some legal thing they can't approve it, but you're saying there is no legal thing that would prevent this union from forming? Can it still go through?
It's entirely at the will of the board. So our process, and I believe you're going to have the professor on later, he was quoted in the same article that that was recently put out that, you know, really the options are change the law or change the board because of the way that Indiana law right now is. Education is definitely a battlefield. I mean, we've seen teachers' unions fight for and lose their full scope of their collective bargaining rights. We've seen them this last legislative cycle come after dues deduction for public sector unions, especially the teachers union. So we know whatever touches the teachers union typically eventually comes to rest with our people as well. So we were prepared to go the distance with this group. So the disturbing piece, however, is the fact that after that vote, they still have not communicated with us. If there is a legal concern that should be addressed, we are more than welcome to have ourselves available for that conversation to figure out how we can do this together.
Is it common to see this kind of pushback with vague language and no response?
That's the first one I've seen in an education group, but I think it is a common tactic of anti-union groups is don't engage, because typically when people do engage, the reality is they're engaging against their own employees, and the optics on that are often not good. So I think they figure if they don't engage, they lay low and they let time pass, that they'll go away. And this group, I mean, I heard Heather talking earlier, this group is resolute, and they're prepared to wait this out and to get this. A couple of the board members that have encouraged the group, the two yes votes, one gentleman after one of the meetings actually told one of the workers, keep struggling, keep pushing. You're going to be stronger in the end because of it.
So it sounds like there is some hope for them to form a union if they have some allies, it sounds like.
Yes, absolutely. And their strongest ally right now, quite frankly, is the community. We put a full page ad in the Kokomo Perspective with a link to their petition, and we've got really good response. And the lovely thing about the petition online is it allows people to chime in with comments, and there's a lot of strong vocal support in the community for this.
If you're listening and have a question or comment on today's program, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Ron Richmond, Director of Political Activity and Communication for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, about a union push from non-teacher school staff in Kokomo, Indiana. Ron, what are the drawbacks to a union forming, just so we can understand the other side? I mean, there's got to be something, some reason why folks are against this.
You know, part of it is whatever this legal concern is, I would love to hear it, because, you know, I'm biased. I know that, you know, I see the definite pros, and they definitely outweigh any concerns, because the whole aspect of being in a union and having a union environment is that you're fostering a relationship, and the contract that you would be able to negotiate defines those boundaries and helps us work together to provide a better product. But I would think from their standpoint, things that I know, you know, shrinking tax revenues means tighter budgets. I mentioned that earlier. Problem with tighter budgets is you have to cut somewhere. So I believe that, you know, when you do have a collective bargaining agreement with a group of employees, you do have to share some of the process, some of the control over the nuances of that relationship. So I think, you know, that's one piece that people hang on to. Sometimes a group may say, you know, it would complicate the process for how we post jobs, how we fill vacancies. Right now, the reality is the bus aides alone were in excess of 40 positions, and now they're down to 25. Heather just called me this morning and said they've lost another driver today to a surrounding district that has better options for them. So again, I think the devil's advocate piece of this is they lose a measure of control over their workforce when they do that.
Right. Well, I've also heard folks who maybe they don't understand unions, or they think that the negative aspect of a union is, for example, only a union employee would be able to do a certain job. Like if you came to an event, it would be like only this union employee is allowed to move this chair. You can't pick it up yourself, for example.
That would be an extreme case, but but I think the reality, though, is especially when you're down almost 20 positions, there really isn't a whole lot of clamoring for who's going to be responsible. Right now, all we're hoping for is to be able to get this group the protection and the structure underneath them to keep them from being constantly 20 positions down, so that they have time to catch their breath between routes, and so they can have a healthy work-life balance, things like that.
Well, with the vote, did it discourage people? Did you see anyone feel like they just don't want to be in this for the long run?
No. In fact, the vote took place. The vote took place very early on in this process. And at that point, it was only the bus personnel that were truly engaged in the process. After that no vote is when the maintenance mechanics and the custodians came in and said, we want part of this too. And as Heather mentioned earlier, also some of the paraprofessionals now are seeming energized and inquisitive about it as well.
Could this set the tone for other unions across the state if it eventually gets through?
It could. I mean, I think that people need to give it a chance and see that, you know, collaboration and that a joint labor management process can work. So I think that, you know, seeing the value in it, I think would definitely be contagious, I hope.
And I know we asked Heather earlier if anything has changed since the vote, or, you know, since everyone's kind of gathered together. Have you seen anything change aside from what it sounds like folks are jumping on board and gathering together for this one cause? Anything else?
Since we've shifted our focus with the petition to engage the community support has been very, very strong. And the other labor groups within the area, Kokomo is a strong labor community. And we've had a lot of the labor groups. I was at a labor breakfast last Friday, and several of them almost sounded like they were taking it personally, that they're like, you let them know we have their backs. This is important to us too. So it's getting some real resounding endorsements for them. So that was encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's a community coming together with a similar cause. Mm-hmm. So, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, which is on the point of it being a labor community, that's why the group actually chose the theme, Why Not Us? Because at least three of the board no votes were former teachers. I think one was a former flight attendant, or maybe currently a flight attendant, but all belonging to unions, having benefited from unions, whether in their family or their personal life, or, you know, it's just been mind-boggling to feel like someone says it's okay for me, but it's not okay for you, and then not really truly give the clear reason as to why.
Oh, that's interesting. Definitely to have someone in a union not want others to be in a union, if that is indeed the case. I don't know the full background of all the board members, but so I guess you're saying that they've only said that this is some legal issue. There's no other transparency as to what is holding this back. Do you expect this to be a long road?
I hope not. I honestly hope not. The reality is, you know, like any organizing process, it's about escalation, that you start and you build your momentum and you build your consensus and you move forward. We will continue to move this process forward and escalate as we go as needed. So I'm hoping for, you know, some more quick resolution, but we are in this and as long as we need to be.
Well, I mean, obviously, money and budgets are part of the issue, probably, for organizations or companies when their employees want to unionize. Do you think the school district has the money to make the changes that people need?
Oh, I definitely think so. We're watching, you know, the influx of money that came from the American Recovery Plan. A lot of districts are using that money in creative ways to help attract and retain and to do some things. Like I say, they're being very creative, Kokomo included. I think Kokomo gave an incentive for vaccinations out of the ARP money. Bloomington Schools, which is another group that we represent, I believe are giving their employees $1,000 each for proof of vaccination. So, you know, there are things that they can do creatively. And at the in the end, you know, working 20 people down in any given department is not a good path to success and retaining your workers. So I think any group benefits from a stable and secure and invested and engaged workforce. And the best way to do that is to allow them to have some control over parts of their work experience.
Would you be okay with a solution if they said we're going to increase pay, for example, of bus aides, and we're going to make sure we have enough folks to run these routes? Would that be a solution, or is it just being able to unionize?
Being able to unionize is a little bit more important to me, in that I've seen what's already happened with this group. They were given the $2 raise. They were given back a component of their pay schedule that they used to have that was taken away. And I think that stability, that having that agreement, having those regulations in place, keeps some of that, because the reality is that pay schedule aspect was there and there's no guarantee that it can be taken away again. The $2 an hour raise was welcomed by the employees, but at what expense? The reality for the district was that they took new hires out of the retirement system, which in some degrees we've seen, you know, when you start pulling people out, it does weaken the system a little bit. I know they had to pay a portion of unfunded liability for those people, but I think the aspect of them having a union behind them helps secure those benefits and those situations a little more long-term than being at the whims of a budget or thinking, oh, but we can take this away from this group now. They've settled down, because I've seen that before. The $2 an hour raise and the adjustment of their pay schedule wasn't on the table until they started trying to unionize. So I see that in other organizing efforts that they try to address the concern superficially and thinking, okay, if we settle them down, they'll go away. It'll all be good. So having a union is an insurance policy to make sure those things stay in place a little bit more long term.
Well, we have about a minute left. What does this tell us, do you think, about the current state of unions in Indiana? Is this indicative of where unions stand, or is this an anomaly?
I see an increased demand for unions across the state and across the country, again, because of some of the awakenings coming out of COVID. Education-wise, though, the state of education unions in Indiana is in large part dictated by the legislative body and the stance that they take against education. Like I had stated earlier, the bill that they passed to make teachers' unions try to recertify their union every year, to try to attack dues deduction, those mm-hmm. concepts are intended to weaken, not strengthen workers.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Ron Richmond is Director of Political Activity and Communication for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We'll be back after a quick break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam So. Back now to our discussion on service worker unions in Indiana. We've been talking about a story out of Kokomo where non-teacher school staff have been trying to get a new union recognized by the board. Now we're talking to a professor of labor law to find out what impact Indiana laws have on the process. With us now is Kenneth Dow Schmidt, Carr Professor of Labor and Employment Law, Maurer School of Law at Indiana University. Welcome, Kenneth.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What laws do we have in Indiana that impact this union push from non-teacher school staff in Kokomo?
Our laws are a little peculiar in the state. We have a general prohibition against public sector collective bargaining, but we have exceptions to it. And one way to have an exception is if you have a specific statute that allows collective bargaining, like the teachers do. And the other way to have an exception is to be specifically excepted from the prohibition, which is way school corporation employees are accepted, and Indiana University employees are accepted. So now the question is, what do you do with an exception from a general prohibition? And I think the best interpretation of that is that they are back under the common law. They don't have a specific statute that gives them a way to organize, but under the common law, they are allowed to collectively bargain. And the school board could voluntarily recognize them and bargain with them. And if they agreed to a collective bargaining agreement, that agreement would be enforceable in a court of law or through arbitration. So while there is a general prohibition in the state of Indiana, I think these school corporation employees could, if the school board wanted to, they could collectively bargain with the school board and they could even sign an enforceable contract. And that's not only my interpretation of that exception to a prohibition. Indiana University, independent of me, our counsel at Indiana University interpret the law the same way. And in fact, we voluntarily bargain with some of our employees because they are also accepted from the prohibition.
It's a lot to take in. That's a lot of stuff. So when it comes to like this situation in Kokomo, do you think that there will be a resolution for what's going on?
Well, you've already seen some motion. I mean, it's funny. The school board says they can't collectively bargain with these people, but they already responded to a request for a pay raise, and they very nearly complied with it. I think, Ron, I was listening to Mr. Richmond from AFSCME. He's right that in part this response is they're hoping that these people will just go away and will give up the idea of organizing, which will mean they'll probably go back to the situation they were in before. But basically, the school board is responding to requests from these employees. They just aren't getting the full benefit of collective bargaining yet because they aren't talking to them face to face and they aren't having talks about other issues that might be important to these employees, like health and safety on the job when they have to deal with the COVID pandemic.
So it's kind of like they have a bit of a union, but not really a union.
Well, it's especially when you're under the common law. you only have as much bargaining power as you actually have. But to request and to stay unified and to make demands, they've already shown that there's some bargaining power here, that the school board needs to respond to them. And to be fair to the employees, the market has moved on. Their wages should be going up. The market has moved on. We're talking about busboys in fast food restaurants now making $15 an hour. And I would hope that school bus drivers, especially with special driver's license, I know that CDL driver's license are in huge demand now. Their wages were too low, and I'm not sure how high they should be, but it doesn't surprise me that they want to bargain with the school corporation to get better wages and to get paid more often, and also to have an agreement on health and safety and other issues that affect them.
Right. And I think the bus aides, from my recollection, make only about $7 or $8 an hour, and it hasn't been raised in forever.
That's way behind the market now. Way behind.
Well, when it comes to laws for other states, do they have things that work more in favor of employees like this trying to bargain?
The states are there's a variety of, well, we have federal laws for the private sector and for federal employees, but for state employees, each state has their own law. And there are a large number of states that have what we call comprehensive public sector labor laws. They have a complete labor law that covers public sector employees and how they organize and how they collectively bargain and whether they can strike and things like that. So there are states that have a quote unquote comprehensive law. Indiana is not like that. Indiana has this piecemeal. We have a few statutes specifically for a few public employees. We have police and firefighters, and we have teachers. And then we have this general prohibition with the exceptions, and the exceptions just kind of leave those employees out in the woolly west. They don't have a legal mechanism through which they can force the school board to recognize them, but the school board could voluntarily recognize them and negotiate with them.
When we talk about the collective bargaining and laws around them, how does Indiana fit compared to other states? Are we doing better? Are we worse?
We're pretty conservative, especially for the Midwest. I mean, there are states that are more conservative about public sector collective bargaining than we are, but most of them are the southern states that you might predict. We are not as generous in collective bargaining, for example, as Illinois or even Wisconsin or Minnesota, Ohio, Michigan, so that we have a fairly restrictive law. Not only do we restrict which employees can collectively bargain, but we are also restrict the subjects that they can bargain over. And we have a prohibition, a flat prohibition on strikes by public employees. That, by the way, is not uncommon. A lot of states prohibit strikes by public employees. So the last time I counted it up, there were only 8 states that allowed any public employees to strike, and none of them allowed police and firefighters to strike, of course. So actually, public sector strikes are actually a fairly rare thing. We had some before the pandemic. I mean, you might have noticed that there were teachers' strikes in a variety of states, in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Colorado, things like that. All of those states, for example, West Virginia does not have a public sector collective bargaining law for teachers, and it's illegal for them to strike. But what happened there was their wages and benefits were so far below market that they needed the legislature to address that. And all of those teachers could have been fired. But when the school boards looked at that, they said, do we really want to fire all our teachers and try to replace them when we pay much lower wages than any of the surrounding states? And the answer is clearly no, right? So that goes back to your prior point, I guess, about sometimes there's the law and what your legal right is, and then there's the question about what you can bargain for. And if your wages get too far below market, in some ways, it's a shame to have that happen, but it does give you bargaining power.
Well, if anybody is listening and has questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Kenneth Dow Schmidt, Carr Professor of Labor and Employment Law at the Moore School of Law at Indiana University. Kenneth, what has the Supreme Court said about collective bargaining? Does that play a role in any of this at all?
It does. It's a tangential role here. I mean, most recently, we've had the Janus case. And what's new about the Janus case from the Supreme Court is that they have said that collective bargaining is the exercise of a First Amendment right. And so therefore there's a freedom from association with unions, but that also implicitly means there's a freedom of association. And it also puts a little bit of impetus. It seems very unfair in some ways that a school board, for example, would bargain with teachers and let them exercise their First Amendment right, but they wouldn't bargain with other employees who also want to exercise their First Amendment right. So it raises an equity issue. It doesn't actually, you know, that the Janus case does not require the Kokomo School Board to bargain with these people, but it does raise a question about, in some ways it raises the status of collective bargaining. It's the exercise of a First Amendment right now, and you've got a question about why wouldn't public officials want to allow employees to exercise that right?
Well, what about the larger trends around collective bargaining? Have there been changes over the last 100 years or so?
Oh, yes. 100 years is a long time. Let's go.
10 years.
Let's go since the New Deal. But we did have, I can give you 100 years if you want, but during the New Deal, that's when our basic labor laws were passed, the National Labor Relations Act. And a lot of states copied the National Labor Relations Act. Even though it's a federal statute, they copied it for public sector, or they came up with something similar to it. And that was a system based kind of on industrial organization. And it was a time when the economy was good and there was not much international trade and American businesses were making a lot of money and the workers could demand a lot of wages. And so our kind of New Deal system of collective bargaining worked well then. Beginning in the early 1980s or the late 1970s, the information technology allowed basically globalization of the workforce. You had, because of the information technology, not only could firms outsource work to foreign countries, but also foreign competitors, it was much easier for them to import their goods into our market. So at least for goods, for manufactured goods that can be made anywhere and then shipped, we went from basically an American market to a global market, and American manufacturing workers were thrown in competition with low-wage Asian workers. I teach in China regularly. I can tell you right now, the minimum wage in Shenzhen is $1.25 an hour, and the employers don't always pay them for all the hours they work. So basically, a worker in Shenzhen, you're competing with a worker who makes about $1 an hour, which is very hard to compete with. So we lost a lot of jobs there, and there was a lot of downward pressure from the 1980s until now. There was a lot of downward pressure on wages and benefits for low-skilled people because there were a lot of jobs going overseas, and a lot of people were being displaced and looking for jobs in that market. Now, that seems to have turned around at least a little bit. I don't want to be too optimistic about this, but even before the pandemic, you could see the teachers clearly had bargaining power. They were clearly being underpaid and they weren't going to be able to be replaced for what they're being paid. Now with the pandemic, people have kind of realized the value of quote unquote low-skilled workers or low-wage workers, and they are also subject to risks from exposure to the public. And both of those have given impetus to, we need to be able to bargain with our employer in order to improve our wages and benefits and in order to negotiate over things like how to deal with the pandemic. So it has led to some impetus. I think Ron talked about that too. Mr. Richmond talked about lately, there has been more impetus to bargain. I also think, I was just reading today, and I've read about this previously, that in part it's, the unemployment compensation benefits affected it, but also time off, people are reevaluating what they want to do with their lives. Some people are retraining to do other jobs. Some people are deciding it's better to stay home. When they look at a low wage job, they're realizing that after childcare and all this, maybe it's not worth it. And as a result, it's hard for low wage employers to try to restart after the pandemic. They are having trouble finding employees, and it's not all just the unemployment comp. If you look at the states where they don't have the unemployment comp, they're having trouble too. It's that the market has moved up. And I was reading just today that basically the floor wage in the fast food industry in Indiana now is $15 an hour. At least that's what was alleged in the Herald Times, and I believe it. And if that's true, low-wage labor across the state is going to have to take a step up, because bus drivers, I would say, are much more valuable employees than a busboy in a fast food restaurant, and they should be paid accordingly.
I mean, it sounds like that can also have repercussions on small companies, mom-and-pop operations that may not be able to pay those high wages, but maybe that's another topic for another time.
Well, I do think it's not that this will come out of thin air. It could raise some prices. It may mean that your hamburger costs a little more. But you're right that the larger firms are probably able to absorb wage increases easier than small firms, because it could affect large firm profits, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, you look at Amazon. There are some companies now that are making unbelievable profits. And it's kind of shocking, really, that their workers aren't paid more or that they have bad working conditions. You're right that there's some small firms that could not respond to that and can't keep their market even if they raise even if prices by their competitors go up. Yes, it might affect some small manufacturers or some small companies.
Well, it sounds like also you mentioned, you know, the pandemic has had a significant impact on things. And one of those, it seems like, is folks reevaluating, maybe thinking about joining a union or forming a union. Do you think that that's going to be more common? Because I feel like unions were talked about a lot maybe 20, 30 years ago. And it was like you knew your grandparents might have been in a union or something, and it wasn't so common. And now it seems like it's kind of coming back to life.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it'll be interesting to see how much this is true. Unions were more popular back when the labor market was good. It is funny. I've studied labor economics for decades now. And something I'm learning out of this experience here is that the labor market has impetus. It has inertia. The market was bad in the 80s. And there was inertia down for a lot of workers, and unions had trouble organizing. Now the impetus, at least the inertia, has changed, and at least right now there is movement up for wages with workers. And workers, it's hard to get all the workers you want. And I would think that would give rebirth to the idea that we could have unions and that we should talk with our employers about what our wages and benefits should be. I think that's absolutely right. We'll see how long it lasts. I mean, we're still in a global economy, although it is true that a lot of those manufacturing jobs that we're going to leave have already left. And something we've learned from the pandemic is it's not good to buy everything from China, because when the next pandemic occurs, you may not be able to get things from China. So I think globalization has not been reversed. That would be naive to think that. But there are some checks now maybe we shouldn't put all our eggs in China's basket.
Well, what about, you know, when we talk about Kokomo, we have about a minute left here. Do you think that there will be a resolution for them? Is Indiana friendly to a resolution for them?
I think the school board members, I'll go on a limb and I predict that they're going to have to come around, because if Kokomo really is a union town, as I've been hearing your other presenters say, there's going to be public pressure on them. These are public officials. Not only that, the bus drivers and the other employees, they can exercise their democratic right and try to get more sympathetic school board members elected. If this becomes an election issue for those people, I could very easily, you can see they've already made concessions. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that the money wasn't there. It's that their attorney has told them, you don't have to bargain. And if you do bargain, it's going to complicate your life or something like that. I think that's very bad advice. It's true that they don't have to bargain, but they should be talking to these employees. These are valued employees. They want them to be long-term employees. They want to keep them around. I can tell you, my school district ran out of bus drivers, and it was a nightmare. They should be talking.
Well, thank you so much, Kenneth Dow Schmidt, Carr Professor of Labor Law and Employment Law at Indiana University's Moorer School of Law. This is All In.